Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Host Gene and Tim, along with team members Teresa and Linda, are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Greene counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
Here's part two of the Fred Briglia interview. This part is about old growth forest, his specialty.
So in these old growth forests, is there a concern that some of these invasive species will get in there and really disrupt the environment?
It is. I mean, so years ago, I was working with a researcher by the name of Neil Peterson. He was studying a lot of trees that are affected by climate change. And a lot of those are trees that sort of southern species, so they do better in warming climates. And then trees like sugar maples, you know, they don't like it as warm. So there's a species migration occurring.
Right.
But then you talk about invasives. And just to give you an example, many years ago, we were doing some work in Minnewaska State Park, and it's what we call the Pomegat Ravine. It's an old growth forest. It holds the current oldest red maple for New York State, Dr. Neil Peterson now. He confirmed that trip with me. And during that trip, we noticed a great chunk of massive old hemlocks, some of the biggest ones and oldest ones that I've documented. And beautiful trees that are, you know, we're talking 300 plus year old trees, easy. And those trees were all affected with, unfortunately, the hemlock woolly adelgid.
Oh, that's what I was afraid you were going to say.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I've gone back to that grove many years later, and I've seen thin crowns and massive loss. They've done things to try to help mitigate it, but unfortunately, you know, we're seeing that happen in a lot of cases. And, you know, it's not just the invasive insects, it's also invasive fungal pathogens. Oak wilt is a big concern for us right now because we're oak people, and the arboretum oaks are our number one dominant tree in our forest. And I can say that I've seen forests that have been impacted with oak wilt, and, you know, trees that are 300 years old, 250 years old, they've lived through storms, they've lived through floods, they've lived through drought, and they've lived through massive winter ice storms with limbs breaking, and a pathogen like oak wilt now takes them out. And, you know, the same story with the elms. There was, you know, right. And then the chestnuts before that.
Is there anything you can do if you have this really precious piece of forest to prevent that? I mean, is there anything that you can do physically to help mitigate that?
I think Mountaintop is doing something. They've got a cluster of hemlocks that they're treating aggressively. I know that they're doing something, but it's so costly.
It is. There is systemics where you can either inject them or do like ground drenching, and the trees will pull that material in, and it'll keep them safe. So you can, in a landscape setting, it's actually not too hard to do. In a forest setting, it's really trickier, but it can be done. But I know at Arnold Arboretum, they had a place called Hemlock Hill, and I think they removed 2,000 hemlocks from, which were, I think, getting close to old growth stage, if not in old growth stage. And I think they lost 2,000, if I've got that number right.
Well, then we've moved to the depressing now, and that was my fault because I asked that question, right?
Well, you know, I mean, you could say it's, you know, depressing, and it certainly can get you down, but, you know, this is not something that's new. We've been dealing with loss, massive loss since the chestnuts, and the forest keeps changing, and it's going to do that again. It's going to change again, and, you know, what we currently call invasives may, by default, be some of our dominant forest trees in the future.
So much of the land in New York State is privately owned. So what do you do about that? I mean, I know you have an arboretum and there's a lot of protected land, but I know there's people who own hundreds and hundreds of acres. Is there an education how to manage your forest, or what do we do about that?
Yeah, I mean, education is the forefront of this sort of frontier. It really is, because if you know a lot about what you're doing before you make those decisions, the decisions you made may be different. The way that we accomplish most of what we do at the Arboretum is through education. Mm-hmm. And so much of what I do online with, you know, social media is just to promote education and promote better, you know, stewardship of our land. We try to promote the need for these trees, and you know, they're not just commodities. In most cases, we realize that they're actually worth more standing than they are being taken down. And, you know, even on a short, you know, think global, act local standpoint, at the Arboretum, we had all these trees on that piece of land were all scheduled to be chopped that the Arboretum Board ended up purchasing and saving. We would have got a few $1,000s for the trees. We've got way more than that through tourism. Yeah. And the visitors and the members that say, hey, we want to join and support your organization. And just the people that go through it alone has, like I said, the return on investment was tenfold. And they're doing that out in the West. They're doing that in, they're trying to, you know, in British Columbia. And old growth being cut down all the time. Right. You know, not so much on public lands in New York or even in California, but on private lands.
Right.
Like you mentioned, it's happening. And if you look at British Columbia in general, they have so much great old growth, and they're losing it, you know, all the time. In fact, there are TV shows out there, which is really maddening, that called big, you know, I hate that, I don't want to use the names, right, but they're based on removing the last stands of old growth. I say it's time to start a TV show where we're actually promoting the preservation of these things. The people that preserve these trees are climbing these trees. They're in, just a few days ago, an adventure just to find a tree that I saw in the distance involved me climbing through brush, crawling on swamp water, covered in ticks, poison ivy galore, and that was just to get to a, you know, to get to a tree that I could see from a dirt road.
Now that's a happy worry.
So
yeah,
that's tree hunting, it'll be fun, they said.
I got another question. Historically, now you got them out there conquering the wilderness, but aren't these trees doing a whole lot of payback with carbon and all that kind of stuff?
They absolutely are. And, you know, that's, if there's one of the biggest benefits of preserving these old trees is that it is storing carbon. Carbon sequestration is huge right now, keeping them up. When a tree dies of old age in a forest, it's not like when you go through and do a clear cut. You're releasing all that carbon back to the atmosphere really, really rapidly. But when a tree dies in a forest, it's dying one here, one there, and it's slowly decomposing. So the storage is immense, and when they do die, the release is in a beneficial way. So yeah, we really need to keep more trees up. We need to keep planting, and we definitely need to keep the trees that are standing that are large. We know the bigger trees can store more carbon.
So you're an advocate for tree planting then too, obviously.
Right? Yeah, because that's going to be the future. You know, plant enough trees. You know, sometimes in the early stage, you know, they don't hold a lot of carbon. In fact, I think in some very early growth, they actually probably produce more than they actually, you know, take, but not in the sense of long, you start thinking long-term, 20, 30 years, we're going to start getting a carbon sink, and then long-term, even more. And, you know, the soils do a lot with carbon sequestration too. So, you know, it's, and the oceans do. So, you know, that it's not just trees. It's all of those components working together with education.
So we're thinking smarter. Now, this brings me back historically yet again to a lot of these old growth forests aren't actually untouched.
Yep, that's another really good point. And, you know, that sort of brings up, you know, some scientists will discredit forests that have had some impact. It's never been touched is the only way they're going to criteria. But nature, just like you say, it always is under change. When you go back to the white pines, Paul Smits and the Elders Grove, you guys had asked me how old, and I don't know if the answer is that those trees are, the oldest ones are approaching close to 300, if right around the 300-year range. So, and those are actually what we call a disturbance-based climax species. So the whole stand grew as a response to some kind of huge blowdown that occurred, or a fire, because ultimately the North Woods old-growth forest develops into a climax stage, and it'll turn into sugar maple, hemlock, barrica beech, yellow birch, places that are too wet. A sugar maple's kind of phases out, and red maple becomes dominant. Places that are too dry, the yellow birch won't be able to handle it, and black birch come in. But that just goes to show you, and those trees at the Elders Grove are at the very end of their span of dominance. So we call it disclimax forest. And disturbance-based climax. So it has its little rain of the sun. The forest goes down. Seeds of white pine now have a chance. There's sun that hits the ground. They come into dominance, and they become the king of the forest. And then eventually they, you know, grow, and they do really good. And then they create a shade condition, and they enable another, that original old-growth forest of Northwoods hardwood, sugar maple, beech, hemlock, birch, it has that ability to start to produce into shades of these trees. And ultimately, the white pines die and the old trees, the new old trees, the climax forest takes over. And that's sort of the massive change that can occur over a long period of time. So change is constant. That's one thing that's a given. And a little bit of disturbance doesn't necessarily negate an old growth.
It's really fascinating. I mean, is there an understanding, though, about the lifespan, say, of an oak? I mean, is there a way to really know what the complete lifespan is? Because there's so many disturbances, does an oak live 500 years and that's it? It's like the end of its life. Because I know there are trees, especially ornamental trees, that last 25 years and that's the end of their lifespan, right? But some of the hardwood trees, do we just not even know what the lifespan can be?
I think part of that information is probably lost because, mm-hmm. We have unfortunately cut down the vast majority of the oldest and biggest hardwoods that we have in our area. But we have had some isolated giant ones that got really old, and there is a lifespan. So to answer that question, there is. Yeah. So, oaks, probably plateau at around 500 is the oldest specimens that we've found.
So there are trees that are pre-colonial in the United States still living, do you think?
Oh, yeah. In New York State, we have the oldest trees in New York State are over 1,000-year-old white cedars in the Niagara Escarpment. It spills into Canada. So Canada and a little bit of New York, where the Niagara Escarpment goes through, it's loaded with old-growth white cedar. And those white cedar, like I say, are the only trees in New York over the 1,000-year range documented. These are all, been verified ages.
In Canada, I just read, I think in the last week, that someone found a tree that they thought was the oldest tree, and I think it's an island off of Canada, perhaps.
I did see something about that. Yeah, so they found, again,
like 1,000 years old or something like that.
Absolutely, yeah. And, that's the amazing thing is that 20 years ago, when I was hunting big trees, I found a tremendous amount of large tracts of or a lot of big specimens, and I submitted them to the state. And at one point, I had like 2/3 of New York State Register in Schoharie County or surrounding counties. This was going back in the late 90s. And after that, 3 or 4 or 5 years of really exhausting those searches, I started to say, I think we maybe have found the vast majority of these large, big trees. 22, 23 comes around. I'm still saying that same thing, only I've got more hope now than I ever did because we are on the ground and we are finding a lot more trees. And I'm not the only one out there. There's a lot of big tree hunters out there. And there's more and more big discoveries coming down. We've been doing a tree hunt for the Arboretum this whole past year, and we've got some, big ones found.
I do see a television series, The Tree Hunter. Good. I mean, come on, let's just produce it now.
That's what
right?
I'm saying. What are we waiting for?
Yeah. Don't they do that Oak Island thing where they keep digging this little tiny island for treasure?
I just
going on for years.
It's called Tree Hunter. It's called Tree Hunter. I'm telling you.
I think it's a natural. I mean, if people are, you can get national television to watch a big tree fall. Trust me, the work we're doing is a lot more interesting.
Absolutely.
Climbing these things to 300 feet to do science.
How do you age a tree, and does it depend on the species in terms of aging? And is it the girth of it? Is it the height? What is it?
So another good question. You guys are loaded with these good ones here today. So a lot of different ways. One of them is we take in cores, which you can sort of get a pretty good age on. A coring is a small hole, and it goes into the trunk, and you're trying to hit the center point, which is, it's a little bit of a mad science to try to find a center point. But even if you don't, you get close to the center point, and you can then get a ring count. And then on those cores, you see little lines, and every line's a ring. So it's like literally the equivalent of taking a cross-section of a tree without cutting it down. So that's certainly one thing that we use. Down material in old-growth forests in general, there's so much dead material. We talked about this coarse woody debris. Mm-hmm. And, we always say, more exploring, less coring. And because there's so much dead wood, You could definitely, there's a lot of t-shirt ideas I've got going here too.
I want iTalk 3, I like
that. So you pull the plug out, you count the rings, and every ring's a year, and that's a good way. You go coarse woody debris, cut through it, and now you've got a cross-section, and that's really accurate because now you can see every single ring, and you know exactly how old that tree is. And a lot of fine sanding, this gets done, back at the house or back at the Arboretum office, and I mount these little plugs of cores to a little thing called a CMB, core mounting base. It's really just a routed out piece of wood, but with an acronym, it sounds more technologically savvy or more scientific. And so we glue them down. The reason we glue them down is if we don't glue them down, you try to sand them, they break apart. They come apart at the rings. So you sand them, you glue them down, and then you fine sand them, and then that lets every single ring really, really show. Yeah. And you sit there, you're just counting them, you know, one, two, three, four. Some of them get, you know, really, really tight. They used to call me the Lord of the Rings back in the old day. So that's another way that we do it. We also can look at, so some of the big trees, like the oak at the Arboretum, was estimated by experts between 400 and 500 years old, which is the sort of ultimate end of Quercus alba or white oak in terms of what we think, you know, maybe 600 out there, but that's, we're at the upper end of the age. And that tree at that point in the game is completely 100% hollow. There's no ring. It was only about 2 or 3 inches of actual living wood, and then you hit hollow. So very little, like a big hollow pipe. And so now how do you age that? Well, a couple of ways. Limbs come off that tree over time, and they have from storms. And when they do, I've taken cross sections of those limbs, and you might say, well, that's just a limb. Well, a lot of those limbs have been on that tree for a great deal of its life. And so if you're aging original limbs, they can give you a lot more data than, let's say, a little side lateral branch. And so those original big scaffold branches, when you cut them, we've got ring counts on the oak, which was estimated between 400 and 500. We've got ring counts on branches that are 300, just on branches of that tree. And we've taken core samples from trees that are not hollow in the very close proximity growing condition to that oak. And we've dated very small trees, very just a fraction of that trunk, to 225 years. So, and I like to be conservative. So, you know, I'd be more pressed to be on the 400 side of things with the oak. But there were estimates that went up as high as 500 on that. And most experts agreed it was over 400, you know, including myself.
So, like, you extrapolate from the branch or the or another tree and
you try
kind
to
of estimate.
Yep, but I will say that extrapolation gets dangerous because what it did for this period may not have been what it did for the rest of its life.
Right.
So when I extrapolate, I do it on the very conservative side. I try to be as conservative as I can. And even my wife, who's also a tree hunter, and you know, she'll be like, Fred, you know, it's probably older than that, right?
We have arguments about tree age.
I'm going to have fun.
She's got a good eye on her, too.
You know, I think you have to marry a tree hunter if you're a tree hunter, right?
You know, just my, you don't try. I don't think you could plan this, but it might just be that that's the way
it works out.
Out.
Well,
I mean,
okay.
There are rock and rollers like Stevie Vai. I was just watching, not the tangent again, but just watching a documentary on him, and he met his future wife in Berkeley, it sounded like, and she ended up being a bassist in the band Vixen, so they were both rock and roll.
You know, free screening.
It's the key to a good
band. Yeah.
It's
good to know.
Definitely. Yeah. You know, strong roots, you know, truth teach us a lot.
Yeah,
he's shameless.
You know, try to stand strong, be proud.
Okay, make him stop. Okay, listen.
Your break, make sure you take time to enjoy the view, folks.
So we always ask the question, and I think you probably have a great answer for this, is kind of what gives you hope as you're out there looking at trees or as managing the arboretum? Because there's a lot of bad news out there, especially ecological news. So what gives you hope?
Yeah, and that's, again, another great question. Kudos to you guys over here. You guys rock, really. You know, I like the program. It's a great podcast. But yeah, what gives me hope? It is. It's tricky because, you know, we are in a world right now with, boy, you know, it's scary to turn on that news sometimes. But first off, I'd say the big one, I had two boys, 8 and 13 right now, Freddie and Mikey. And that's the same name as, you know, Freddie and my brother Mikey. And my dad was also Freddie and Mikey. So they're the thirds generations. And the brains and seeing not just their brains, but all their friends and how they interact. And you look at that young generation and, man, it's hard not to have hope when you see that. You know, also, I think a big part of it, and it's kept me, you know, sort of, this has been my mindset for a long time, when you've seen forests that you tried to protect and then they're all cut down, or series of trees that you tried to protect at this historic house and they're cut down in the middle of the night before the planning board can even have a chance to rule on the vote. Someone takes them out. And there's some, you know, recent news about in Sycamore Gap in England, I believe it was, where they, you know, took out a, you know, prominent tree. And, you know, that kind of stuff really can get you down. But the work that we are doing can keep you uplifted, because we like to say we're really having a lot of fun being part of the solution. And go to work every day with that kind of mission in your brain, it's gonna create, you know, a lot of positivity, and that's what keeps me going. It's don't plant the bad days, plant the good ones. So when those trees go down, you just try not to focus on that. But hey, we save that and we save that forest. And you know, the Zora Valley out in western New York was saved. It was one of the tallest deciduous forests in New York State, and it was all scheduled to be cut. It was saved, and you know, at the end of that kind of a mission, you know, that, those are the days to plant. Don't plant the bad days, plant the good ones.
I see. I knew Fred would have a good answer. He's now my new therapist.
Yeah. Too, and if you want to hear more from Fred, he's regular on WAMC Public Radio's Vox Pop series. He's always got something new going on. We've got contact information for the Arboretum and the Big Tree groups in the show notes. Full disclosure, I've been to the Landis Arboretum several times. It's easy to find. They throw awesome fundraising galas. Their plant sale is terrifying. And they have a great 5K race. Fred, what is your favorite event?
You know, probably that plant sale. I mean, you know, and I think that the answer kind of comes easy because when I started working at the Arboretum 25 years ago, the thing that I liked most about the Arboretum was the plants. But it was really close second to the people. And, you know, the people at the plant sales, it's, you know, it's a camaraderie of great volunteers that help make it happen, a dedicated staff or a dedicated board of trustees. And then the best of it all is the plant sales, a great time for me to be at a chat with a lot of people that are looking for information, people that, hey, you know, I'd like to get a chance to say hello to Fred. I'm always, you know, obviously working the plant sales and, you know, a lot of followers, a lot of, you know, people that have questions. I get them all, and Arboretum diehard members, and, you know, it's a great chance to really talk. And like I said, it's a toss-up, you know. People are really, really right up there with the plants at Landis. It's a great event. And place is free. It's open dawn to dusk year-round. And there's not too many things in the world that I think are, you know, truly free. And our site is, you don't need to be a member, but, you know, memberships help keep us growing. So, you know, if you want to join, great. But dawn to dusk, 365 days a year, the site's there, and we were there through all the COVID pandemic, and I know we were, you know, hopefully going to talk more about that, or I think it was part of your list, but, you know, more people came out than ever, and, you know, we've seen that sort of trend continue, and, you know, so that was definitely, you know, a big part of it, but, you know, all the events are fun, you know, they're really great.
Thank you for coming. This has been really fascinating, and we're only going to let you leave if you promise to come back again and talk to us about champion trees and other...
I'll come back.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
And thanks to our listeners, too. Okay.
Thank you.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at columbiagreenmgb@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.